Well, the time now is 4 o'clock, and in just a minute on Fresh Air, I'll be speaking with New York Times music critic John Rockwell. We'll be discussing Frank Sinatra, which is the subject of his new critical biography. Before we meet him, let's listen to a selection from the first album that Sinatra recorded with Nelson Riddle. And this is, let's see, what are we going to play here? I think
In the Wee Small Hours,
Last Night When We Were Young. Right. Okay, and we'll be hearing a lot more a little later in the program.
Last night, when we were young, love was a star, a song unsung. Life was so new, so real, so right. Ages ago, last night, today, the world is old. You flew away, and time grew cold. Where is that star that seems so bright? Ages ago, last night, to think that spring had depended on merely this, a look, a kiss. Something so splendid could slip away in one little daybreak. So now let's reminisce and recollect the sighs and the kisses, the arms that clung when we were young.
That was Frank Sinatra. And with me now is New York Times music critic John Rockwell, who's written a new critical biography of Frank Sinatra titled Sinatra, an American Classic. He opens the book by saying Frank Sinatra is, by any reasonable criterion, the greatest singer in the history of American popular music, and by every measure, an extraordinarily complex man. I'm sure comedian Joe Piscopo would agree with that statement. He spent days at a time watching Sinatra movies and TV shows and listening to Sinatra records as background for his characterization of Sinatra. And tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, I'll speak with Piscopo about his Sinatra characterization and about the other celebrities Piscopo did for Saturday Night Live, like David Hartman, David Letterman, and Joan Rivers. So that's comedian Joe Piscopo on Fresh Air tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Sinatra was the first music teen idol. He's lived long enough and has behaved wildly enough to see his popularity rise and fall several times. Sinatra's career and the impact his singing has had on American popular music and culture are the subjects of Rockwell's new book, Sinatra, an American Classic, which is published by Random House. New York Times music critic John Rockwell last joined us a couple of years ago after the publication of his book, All American Music. I want to welcome you back to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
And I want to mention also that we'll be hearing selections from Sinatra's recording career, selections that span his career. You, I imagine, grew up during the period when rock and roll was raging war with pop music in America. Did you like Sinatra when you were young?
Well,
and
you
heard him on the radio and TV?
It's funny about that because I'm 44. I was born in 1940, which makes me a little young to be a Bobby Soxer. And I didn't have a particularly musical family. I mean, my parents played a couple of instruments, but they didn't do it often. But I remember listening to the radio in the late 40s and early 50s. But Sinatra, of course, that was at the absolute slump in Sinatra's career. I remember Mule Train and Ghost Riders in the Sky and Frankie Lane and Johnny Ray and various ditzy novelty songs of one kind or another that were popular in the early 50s. And first pop song I can remember really loving was 16 Tons of Tennessee Ernie Ford. And I really just went nuts for Rock Around the Clock and, you know, Bill Haley and early Elvis Presley and so forth. But my contact – so it was rock and roll and then classical music that I was really listening to a lot in the mid-late 50s. But my awareness of Sinatra was really more as a movie star than as a film star. But I do recall at the age of 12, I was really caught up in the drama of Sinatra's comeback. I mean, I saw From Here to Eternity, uh-huh. and I was impressed with Sinatra, but I was just as impressed with a kind of showbiz story of this sort of scrappy kid who'd been down and out and who was battling back for respect and self-respect and all of that. And then, you know, I saw High Society and Man with the Golden Arm and all those movies of the mid-60s, you know, Can-Can and all, you know, all the big Sinatra movies of the 50s. But it was really only after I came to the New York Times in 1972 and sort of got regularly and sort of officially into reviewing popular music. And that was just about the time of the old Blue Eyes Is Back comeback tour. And so I reviewed Sinatra in concert. I guess it must have been 73. And that was the first time that I recall ever actually seeing him in concert. And I really was impressed with the show. And from then on, all during the 70s, I began to collect Sinatra records, not so much the new ones as the Columbia Greatest Hits records, the various Capitol albums and Reprise albums. But then that Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab 16-record audiophile set of nearly all of the Capitol albums came out, and then one of the blessings of being a critic in this wonderful society is that you get stuff like that for nothing. So I got it and listened to it. The experience of listening to those albums sequentially really made you aware of them as a unified body of work. Most of them were arranged and conducted by Nelson Riddle, and there was a real series of statements being made there, and they really are his greatest records, Sinatra's. Riddle's too, for that matter. And so that really solidified it.
You write that everyone who writes about Sinatra pays lip service to what a great singer he is, but what they really spend time talking about is how he was a womanizer and a brawler. He has a pretty unsavory past and present in many ways. How do you reconcile his personality and his showbiz persona, the whole ring-a-ding-ding stuff, with the singing that he does, with the transcendent singing?
Well, there's a lot of answers to those questions. First of all, the ring-a-ding-ding side of him is certainly one side of him. In other words, the Sinatra public image has always been balanced between a kind of macho finger-popping, well, not always, since the 50s, has been balanced between a kind of macho finger-popping, hep-cat, up-tempo swing. And I must say that most of the sort of real die-hard Sinatra fans that I've encountered, especially on this wandering around the country talking about this book, have been their real favorites if they had to go to a desert island to be with the up-tempo Sinatra. And my preferences tend to be with the other side of his public image, which is the vulnerable torch song ballad side. So that's one answer. Another answer is that when I was contemplating writing this book, and although I no doubt was buoyed by an inner impulse almost overpowering in its intensity, that it was triggered by the fact that Rolling Stone Press, who publishes this book in conjunction with Random House, asked me to write it. But when I was thinking about whether I would do it, one of the things, of many things that fascinated me about Sinatra was what I now like to call the sort of the Amadeus syndrome. In other words, the idea of great art produced by a bad or weird guy. Richard Wagner is another one of my heroes, and he fits in the same rough category. I mean, people idolized Wagner, but people hated him as well. In writing the book, which I think it's less a sort of hardcore investigative thing in which I dig out hot new facts about Sinatra's relationship with the mafia or whatever. It's less that than it is an interpretive biographical essay as well as an analytical essay about his art. But in thinking about his life and reading all kinds of accounts of it and so forth, there are plenty of things that he did that, while they are no less excusable, still become more understandable when you consider the context in which he grew out of, his character, his personality, the pressures that were on him as a celebrity and public figure, and so forth. So although he's not necessarily always this wonderful human being, his hot-tempered and mean sides can be put into context and also do anticipate rock and roll rebellion in a kind of fascinating way.
I want to play one of his very early recordings with the Harry James Band, which is probably from the mid-1930s.
Well, no, it's from 1939. It's actually kind of interesting history because it was recorded in 1939 and only sold about 8,000 copies. And then it was re-released in 1943 after Sinatra had gone out on his own, and when there was a recording ban on during the Second World War, Jimmy Petrillo's strike and all of that, and then it sold millions of copies.
How well known was he before he joined the James Band?
He was very unknown. He had toured briefly in 1935 with a kind of ad hoc group called the Hoboken Four after winning the Major Bowes Amateur Hour, but he hadn't liked them or their music much and had returned to the obscurity of the Jersey club circuit. And even when he was with James, James was a fledgling band leader in those days. He wasn't as famous as he subsequently became. It was only in 1940 when Sinatra went with Tommy Dorsey that he really joined a really famous band. It should be pointed out just in passing that that was the mechanism by which singers and even songwriters became famous in those days. The songwriters sold their songs to singers or to bandleaders, got them featured with bandleaders. Singers became vocalists with bands, but the real keys to the power were the bandleaders themselves.
Why don't we hear this recording from 1939 with Frank Sinatra and the Harry James Band, and we'll hear All or Nothing at All.
Nothing at all. Half a love never appealed to me. If your heart never could yield to me, then I'd rather have nothing. Nothing at all. If it's love, there is no in between. Why begin and cry for something that might have been? No, I'd rather have nothing at all. Bring your lips so close to my cheek. Don't smile or I'll be lost beyond recall. The kiss in your eyes and the touch of your hand makes me weak, and my heart may grow dizzy and fall. And if I fell under the spell of your call, I would be caught in the undertow. And so you see, I've got to say no.
That was Frank Sinatra with Harry James and his orchestra. And with me on Fresh Air is New York Times music critic John Rockwell, who's just written a new book called Sinatra. He didn't spend that much time with the Harry James Band. When did he make the transition from James to Dorsey, and how did he?
Right at the end of 39 into 40. He was only with James for about 6 months, and by all accounts, James was simply very gracious about letting him out of his contract. The reason being that as I said, James was really not that big, didn't have a big clout on the big band scene. I mean, these swing bands with their sweet arrangements of the sort you just heard really were the dominant. I mean, we think of them now in part as part of the history of jazz, but they really were right on the cusp between jazz and pop. And so this was like the predominant popular music vehicle of the times. And right at this time, probably the two leading ones were Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey. And when Tommy Dorsey wanted to engage Sinatra as his featured vocalist, it was such a big step up for Sinatra's career that James was cool about it, as we say.
Why don't we hear the song that was the first hit that he had with Dorsey, I'll Never Smile Again. Do you want to say anything to introduce
it? Yeah, well, this is not recorded not too long after All or Nothing at All, and it was recorded right at the beginning of 1940. And when we come back after this, we can talk about the vocal style that Sinatra had in both these records. But one thing that's kind of an interesting sort of anachronistic curiosity about I'll Never Smile Again is the presence of this slightly sappy sounding to modern ears a cappella choral group, in this case called the Pied Pipers. This was a real feature of this kind of recording, and it does tend to date them a bit to modern listeners, but it really was not an eccentricity. In fact, there was even a period briefly right at the beginning of the recording strike to which I referred when instrumentalists couldn't make records because of this recording strike, and there was a brief period in which they made a number of records with just singing voices, a cappella choruses and choral groups with Sinatra. There's several records, many of them arranged by Alec Wilder, that came around this time, and that was purely an accident because of this recording strike, but it did represent an outgrowth of the prevalence of this kind of harmony group in normal recordings just before that time.
Okay, well, let's listen to Frank Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, and this is I'll Never Smile Again, recorded in 1940.
What good would it do? For tears would fill my eyes, my heart would realize that all. Thank you.
Frank Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, recorded in 1940. And with me is New York Times music critic John Rockwell, and we're talking about Sinatra, and that's also the title of his new book, Sinatra, an American Classic. Big bands were really like the pop music of the period.
Yeah, they really were. But you know, I think that in part what's really most interesting about those two records is, in terms of trying to discuss it and vis-a-vis Sinatra's whole career, is to think specifically about the singing style that he was going through just then compared to what he later evolved into. I mean, without getting too epigrammatic here, let me just sort of try to compress the sort of main argument in the book about the evolution of his singing style, which is borrowed to some extent from a man named Henry Pleasance, to whom the book is dedicated. The basic idea is that the advent, there were sort of three events that happened between 1925 and 1930 that were absolutely crucial to the evolution of pop singing style in America or in the world. In 1925 was the advent of the electrical recording process, which offered a whole new kind of fidelity as it superseded the acoustical process. In 1927 and 28 were the institution of the first nationwide radio networks. And around 1930 was the advent of concert amplification for singers. These three things, all obviously related, meant that singers, first of all, could project their images and their personalities around the country and become nationwide stars in ways that, with an immediacy and a completeness that they couldn't have before. But the electrical recording process, and more crucially, the concert amplification, meant that a singer no longer had to invest a disproportionate amount of his energy and time into the projection of volume and brilliance. Essentially, what had happened with singing style in the Western world from the beginning of opera in around the 1600 to the late 19th century was a fairly steady rise in the size of opera houses, the size of the orchestral accompaniments which accompanied them, and the demands of the public for brilliance and high notes. This was particularly dramatic around 1830 to 1850 when singers, male singers especially, began to take their high notes, as they say, from the chest. In other words, belt out sort of thrilling high notes in the matter of Caruso or Pavarotti, rather than sort of easing them out in a kind of mixture of falsetto and head tone with normal chest production. So by the end of the 19th century, opera singing had developed into a kind of verismo belting sound. Now, pop music up until the 1920s was much closer to operatic singing than it subsequently became. Your typical opera singer was also a belter, and opera singers and pop singers often interchange. Caruso recorded pop songs. Lawrence Tibbett, the Metropolitan Opera baritone, replaced Sinatra on the hit parade in 1945. And the big change came with the advent of the microphone, which enabled singers to turn their attentions to intimacy, directness, naturalness, conversational simplicity. This kind of thing can really be seen in the career of a man like Fred Astaire, who in his very early recordings from the 20s, sounds like a sort of light opera singer, sort of belting it out, and then became the kind of wispy conversationalist that we know from later in life. Sinatra came into prominence with his not too much older first idol being Bing Crosby, who was really the first big star made by the nationwide radio networks. But even from his mid-teens, Sinatra was aware of the fact that if he was going to be a big success in his business, he had to differentiate himself in some way from Crosby, who was such a familiar sound on the radio. And so he decided, with what degree of intellection and instinction we don't know, to reinvest his singing with a kind of flowing melodic grace. Now, he cited several influences for this. One was his Italian heritage. Two was Tommy Dorsey's trombone playing. Three was Yasha Heifetz's violin playing. All kinds of influences were reduced. But whatever the actual cause, in these records that we just heard, All or Nothing at All with James in 39 and I'll Never Smile Again with Dorsey in 40, you have a singer primarily concerned with liquid flow of sound. He, at this time in his career, was a light baritone, almost near a tenor. And what's primarily distinctive about these records is their melodic beauty, the seamlessness of the phrasing, the lack of gulping breaths, and the complete lack of kind of stentorian rhetoric or up-tempo energy. We're talking dreamy ballads, and the vast majority of Sinatra's hits into the late 40s, when he was still a Bobby Soxer idol after he went solo, and late 42, early 43, were in this mold of dreamy ballads of one kind or another. I mean, do you want to play? I mean, we have one more cut here that comes from sort of the middle of his solo period with his primary arranger of the mid-40s, Axel Stordahl. Why don't we listen to that?
Sure, why don't we listen to that? And we're going to hear I've Got a Crush on You, the Gershwin song. And this features Frank Sinatra, an arrangement that we think is by Axel Stordahl.
Which is also, we should point out, a song that Linda Ronstadt, one of the many Sinatra songs, songs identified with Sinatra that Linda Ronstadt has re-recorded on her too.
You want to tell us briefly if you like her interpretations?
Well,
of those
I
songs?
Do, yeah. I mean, let's face it. I mean, it's a matter of some controversy, just as her interpretations in the rock and soul and country field are also controversial. Some people, especially Sinatra loyalists, find them bland and unthinking. I think that she is, I love the sound of her voice, and I think that as an honorable extension of kind of the girl singer tradition, which was actually a very viable tradition, she does a beautiful sort of female ingenue job on songs that are often associated with sort of tougher women and or men. But in any case, this is Sinatra's version from the mid-40s.
How glad the many millions of Annabelles and Lillians would be to capture me. But you had such persistence, you wore down my resistance. I fell, and it was swell. I'm your big and brave and handsome Romeo. How I won you, I shall never, never know. It's not that you're attractive, but oh, my heart grew active when you came into view. I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie. The day and night time, hear me sigh. I never had the least notion that I could fall with so much emotion. Could you coo? Could you care for a cunning cottage? We could share, the world will pardon my mush, 'cause I have got a crush, my baby. That we could share, the world will pardon my mush, 'cause I have got a crush, my baby, on you.
That was Frank Sinatra singing I've Got a Crush on You, and my guest is New York Times music critic John Rockwell, author of a new book called Sinatra. Do you think that Sinatra's popularity with teenagers, with Bobby Soxers, is equatable with, say, Elvis Presley's popularity with teenagers or the Beatles' popularity?
Absolutely. I mean, they were the identical phenomenon. I mean, obviously, the differences are that with Elvis and then the Beatles and all the subsequent ones, you have a representation of the sort of upsurge of energetic, sexually liberated, lower class, urban black, rural white energies into the mainstream, which probably represents a more profound sociological and musical impact on American culture than this, which was kind of the tail end from a musical standpoint of a kind of a post-operetta European-dominated pop music tradition. Still in all, with the advent of all these electronic media that I referred to and with Sinatra's cleverness in capitalizing on them, he really does count as the first of the modern youth idols in music. I mean, the same kind of sociological response, the same hysteria from young girls and to some extent young men as well. I mean, it really is the same phenomenon. And the fact that it was achieved with a dreamier, more romantic kind of music rather than a up-tempo dance music is of interest, but the hysteria of the response and the intensity and the kind of sexual yearning of young kids and stuff was identical. However, it was short-lived, as a lot of youth idols find themselves, and Sinatra found himself on the downslide soon after, he only had about 4 years of a peak until he started going downhill around 47.
What do you think was responsible for that decline?
It's really a complex thing. I mean, one thing I think is the sort of built-in sort of time bomb factor of youth idol popularity. Another you could argue was the return of people from the war, not so much that, you know, better singers came back who'd been at the front, not so much that, but obviously the whole mood of the country changed, their tastes changed. I argue in the book that although rock and roll itself didn't hit America until 54 or 5, that all kinds of premonitions of rock were already in evidence in the mainstream by the late 40s with sort of proto-country songs like Mule Train and Ghost Riders in the Sky and belting, which obviously owed something to black gospel kind of sounds. And you know, there was a whole shift in the air, and Sinatra was unsure of himself. I mean, he hadn't yet evolved the kind of swinging, more up-tempo energy idiom that he manifested after 53 and was sort of trapped in this dreamy ballad thing and trying to experiment but not really finding his way out. Another problem was his increasingly tumultuous love life, which was seized upon by the gossip columnists in a time when, you know, Ingrid Bergman and people like that were still being punished for sexual transgressions that would be ignored today. And, you know, his involvement in the late 40s with an obsession with Ava Gardner, which culminated in their marriage in 1951. And I mean, they were married in Philadelphia, but didn't smooth it out. I mean, it was still tempestuous in terms of his own personal life. And then there was the surfacing of the first sort of serious Frank Sinatra consorts with mobsters stories, which started in 1947 when he was spotted hanging out with Lucky Luciano and other hoodlums in Havana. I don't know why I'm saying Havana. What kind of a class act am I? Anyway, but one of the things that was interesting when I was researching the book was that a case can be made, I mean, not definitive, but a case can be made that much of the animus against Sinatra then and now has been politically motivated. In other words, he was quite strongly identified with the left in the 40s and 50s, and he was almost regarded as quasi-communist by various pre-McCarthy investigative committees of one kind or another, naming names of people in show business who were associated in some way with the Communist Party. Sinatra's name would surface on those lists. And as a result, there were various people in government and in the right-wing press who were out to get him because they thought he was, quote, pink, close quote. And so there's a fair degree of, leaks to right-wing gossip columnists from government agencies about Sinatra's supposed mafia carryings on. And now, of course, that he's associated in people's minds with the right, equally correctly, there is a certain animus against him from the left. I'm not saying that there isn't personal animus or that that he hasn't done bad things or at least inadvisable things at one time or another in his life, but at least that can be considered in the balance of the whole picture.
During that period of his decline in the, late 40s?
Late 40s into early 50s, yeah.
Mitch Miller was his producer.
That's a whole other series of factors, actually. I mean, there was a series of odd his sort of mentor, a man named George Evans, died in 1950. The guy who was his principal ally and head of recording at Columbia Records, Manny Sachs, quit in 1950 and is replaced by Mitch Miller, who, of course, is still with us today, and so is Frank Sinatra. But there was definite bad blood between them. Mitch Miller can take credit for helping to foster the careers of some of the belters of the late 40s. And there was, but on the end, by the same token, oversaw a shift in taste that worked against Sinatra. But he also was particularly obsessed in the early 50s with sort of silly novelty songs. Now, a number of those songs did in fact become hits, but they really were hard to take for those who were more seriously self-regarded like Sinatra. And Sinatra himself made a few of these records, the most notorious being one called Mama Will Bark in 1951, which is a duet with Dagmar with Obligato Dog Barks. But I love the idea that you and I are having this serious conversation about Obligato Dog Barks, but hey, you know, everything on radio. At any rate, he really was flailing around. I mean, he'd always shown something of a penchant for experimentation as early as 1945 at the height of his early success. He'd been playing with jazz musicians and black gospel groups and all that. But the experimentations of the late 40s and early 50s were really born of desperation. And by the 51, 52, he had lost his booking agency. He'd lost his Columbia recording contract. And he was wandering forlornly around the world in pursuit of Ava Gardner to studio locations where she'd been sent to get her out of his way. And he really was at the end of his tether.
What do you think is the beginning of his comeback? Do you think it has to do with his movies or with hooking up with Nelson Riddle?
Well, not specifically hitting. I mean, it was nice and terrific and for the future that he hooked up with Nelson Riddle. But no, I mean, in all sort of Hollywood careers these days, Hollywood recording careers, the movies and music feed back and forth. And that was particularly obvious right at this time because I do think that getting the part of Maggio in From Here to Eternity and then acting it in a way that he liked and Hollywood insiders liked was crucial to the process of the rebuilding of his own self-confidence and his sort of showbiz insider rep as somebody who really did in fact still have something to say. But he had gotten his recording contract with Capitol even before, I believe, he began shooting From Here to Eternity. And so it all sort of worked together. But it was no question that the momentum of his first getting the role, then acting it well, then buzz around Hollywood that he had acted it well, followed by popular success when the movie came out and then culminated by winning the Oscar in early 54, really was the principal public manifestation of his comeback. But by the time he won the Oscar, he already had a hit again with Young at Heart and was on a roll. And at that point, he really had his greatest period. His greatest period of commercial success was from the 53 to into the early mid-60s. His greatest records were made then. His greatest movies were made then. And it's sometimes, for those sometimes who feel that pop music sort of the standard Tin Pan Alley type ended in 55 to be replaced by rock and roll, for better or for worse, it's easy to forget that Sinatra really was on an absolute roll by the late 50s into the early 60s. One reason, however, was that he really stopped being a singles artist. He was primarily an album artist, both in terms of what he had to say musically, but also in terms of his commercial success. Some of these albums like Only the Lonely were on the charts for 2 years, had a shelf life comparable to classical records. But really the 50s and into the early Reprise years are really his greatest period.
Why don't we play something from Only the Lonely? And we're going to hear one from My Baby, which is one of his best known recordings. Do you want to say anything about
this? I think at this point, for what I have to say about this, really, people should go out and buy the book. I mean, however, the fact is that I wanted, when you're writing a book like this, from an organizational standpoint, it's tricky to try to strike a balance between obsession with detail and sort of precise description of individual performances and all that and maintaining the generalities and the overall narrative line. And I knew that when I was going to organize this book that I wanted to find one performance of one song that I would zero in on considerable detail. I do kind of sort of geological cross-sections of strata all through the book, comparing the same song recorded at different periods and that kind of thing. But I wanted to spend a lot of space on one song. And for a variety of reasons, many of them attributable to Twyla Tharp and her Sinatra ballets, I picked this 1958 Nelson Riddle arranged and conducted recording of Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer's One for My Baby and One More for the Road. The reason I picked it, there are a lot of reasons, and I try to go into sort of how this song is structured and the harmonic relationships as well as how Sinatra sings it. But a simple reason to explain why I picked this song, other than my basic predilection for ballads, is that this song, as well as any other, shows how Sinatra's skills as an actor enlivened his musical performances. He really was a master, or is a master, at shaping a lyric, telling a narrative tale in music, and this performance really illustrates that as well as any.
Why don't we hear it?
It's quarter to three. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road. I got the routine, put another nickel in the machine. Feeling so bad, can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you've gotta be true to your code. Just make it one for my baby and one more for the road. You'd never know it, but buddy, I'm a kind of poet, and I got a lot of things I'd like to say. And when I'm gloomy, won't you listen to me till it's talked away? Well, that's how it goes. And Joe, I know you're getting anxious to close. And thanks for the cheer. I hope you didn't mind my bending your ear. But this torch that I found, it's gotta be drowned, or it soon might explode. So make it one for my baby and one more for the road. The long, it's so long, the long, very long,
that was Frank Sinatra. Arrangement by Nelson Riddle. And my guest is New York Times music critic John Rockwell, who's written a new book called Sinatra. And the book is not only a critical biography, but it's highly illustrated with photos of Sinatra from his childhood and then throughout his career. I think of that as being not only one of Sinatra's best recordings, but one of Nelson Riddle's best arrangements. Now, Riddle, too, is in this tremendous period of comeback now. Linda Ronstadt is recording records arranged by him, and everyone seems to be toasting him now. Do you think that he's a great arranger?
Yeah, I do. I mean, obviously, the whole notion of a studio band or a studio orchestra, which has some connection, of course, with the swing bands themselves, but an equal connection with a kind of mutated version of the symphony orchestra itself, strikes people whose tastes in popular music are conditioned by the sound of a rock band with its highly amplified electric guitars and powerful drumming underbeat and all of that as inherently anachronistic and perhaps a little sappy and sentimental to boot. However, in my view, to some extent, that's a prejudice best overcome rather than wallowed in. But also, to some extent, whether you have the prejudice or not, that Riddle is far and away the most restrained, precise, and least mannered of all of these people, certainly of all of the arrangers Sinatra ever had. What makes Riddle's arrangements quite, you know, so extraordinary is the almost Japanese sparsity which he applies those things. When you think of that arrangement of One for My Baby, I mean, basically you have an extended piano solo by Bill Miller. You have a few quiet strings, and you have a sax solo, and that's really it. Yet the sensation is of real cushioning accompaniment rather than just these daubs. He really uses only what he has to, but he does use what he has to. Sometimes he'll use a larger wash of a violin sound, but it's never mannered. And the up-tempo swing stuff is also wonderfully subtle. I mean, often the brass instruments are literally muted, using mutes. That kind of steamroller effect that sort of the Norman Granz jazz at the Philharmonic kind of big band arrangements, and Billy May certainly had a lot of that in his subsequent Sinatra arrangements. That can be exhilarating, but it also tends to sound more dated. Riddle always seems to be in control of the stylistic signatures of that kind of arrangement.
You had mentioned before that you thought that the emergence of rock and roll was one of the reasons for Sinatra's first decline. How do you think he related to rock and roll material in the 1960s?
Well, I actually said was that the first decline was triggered by a shift in taste, which can be interpreted in retrospect as premonitions of rock and roll.
Okay.
I mean, rock and roll itself didn't really come along until 54 or 5, although Greil Marcus and other rock critics will argue that groups like the Orioles, which had race hits, so-called, in as early as 47, constituted real rock and roll. But in terms of the mainstream, it didn't happen until 54 or 5. Oddly enough, Sinatra did manage to ride through the first wave of rock unscathed from a commercial standpoint. In other words, Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard and all those people. That wave of Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, they didn't affect his commercial success, which was riding high in the mid-late 50s into the early 60s. And after, of course, the late 50s into the early 60s, it looked as if rock may have been a novelty that was subsiding. Everybody in the Tin Pan Alley side thought that was the case because so many of them were in the army or dead or in jail or whatever happened to the avatars of early rock. But with the Beatles and the British Invasion from 64 on, and with the sort of canonization of an official youth culture by the mid-60s, and with the shifting over of the record companies to aggressive youth music policies led by Clive Davis and others, things really began to look bad for Sinatra in the late 60s. Now, in the mid-late 60s are some of Sinatra's most beautiful and interesting collaborations and experiments. One of his most beautiful ballad albums, really touched with nostalgia and regret, at the occasion of his 50th birthday, September of My Years, which came out in 1965, was a particularly wonderful Sinatra album. The Basie collaborations have their charms. The Ellington collaboration certainly has its merits. The collaboration with Antonio Carlos Jobim was really beautiful and sort of a record and a half, because a third side of it came out on the record Sinatra and Company right in the early 70s. But in any case, there were some interesting records in the mid-late 60s. But basically, from starting around 66, he entered into a period of increasing unsureness as he sort of tried to adapt to the new sounds. There was a Rod McEwen record. There was that cycle called Watertown, which actually has its charms. There was a record called Cycles, which was full of rather incongruous things of one kind or another. And so, and then, of course, he himself was fully aware of the incongruity of his own position, and there was the official retirement from 1971 to 73. But even with the comeback in 73-4, Sinatra remained more a concert artist and was still unsure of what he wanted to do. He went into the studio very sparingly during the 70s. Many of the sessions that he indulged in, such as three of his standards cut as disco versions in 1977, were sporadically or not at all released. And it was really only until starting with 1979 that he seems to have made something of a commitment to stick with the sound of the studio orchestra and the big band, and essentially to retain his fidelity to his roots and damn contemporaneity. And it was just about that time, of course, that the country itself began to shift to the right politically. The arts began to move into kind of a postmodernist accessibility and even conservatism. In other words, the zeitgeist, in a way, sort of shifted around to welcome his own decision to return to his roots. And so, therefore, it's been in the last 5 years that he really has come into his own as a kind of elder statesman of American popular music.
Well, he even has a new album out called L.A. Is My Lady. And why don't we listen to a selection from it so we could hear what his voice sounds like now.
And then we can talk a little bit about both the voice and the style that he's evolved in his later period.
Okay, and we'll hear him singing Stormy Weather from Sinatra's latest album, L.A. Is My Lady.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather. Since my gal and I, we ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather. Can't seem to get my poor old self together. I'm weary all of the time, the time. She stays away, old rocking chair's bound to get me. All I do is pray that the good Lord above will let me walk in that sun once more and go on. Every single thing I had is gone. Stormy weather. Can't get myself together. Keeps raining all the time. Since my gal and I, we ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Keeps raining all of the time. Thank you.
Frank Sinatra singing Stormy Weather with arrangements by Quincy Jones from his new album, L.A. Is My Lady. And I'm with New York Times music critic John Rockwell, author of the new book, Sinatra. Well, throughout this past hour, we've heard from records from Sinatra's early recording career to the present. How do you think his voice has changed over those years?
I think that's a real successful performance, but there's no question that his voice has dropped a little bit in pitch, become a little more gravelly and fragile, but he has been very clever about adapting his style and his individual songs to suit the peculiarities of his voice. He knows how to use the fragility for expressive purposes. He's having lost some of that smooth legato breath control that we heard at the beginning of the hour. He's shifted now to shorter tempos, more emphatic phrasing, things that don't require the sustenance of notes, long notes. Also, that accompaniment, which was actually produced but not arranged by Quincy Jones, is of interest because I think it's a very successful accompaniment. And, of course, people say, gee, Frank's not just jumping on the Michael Jackson bandwagon by going with Quincy Jones, who produced all of Michael Jackson's records. But, of course, he'd worked with Quincy Jones 20 years ago when Quincy Jones was Count Basie's arranger and they'd toured together and made those records. But I think that's a very interesting – I mean, it's basically obviously a big band arrangement, but it's full of kind of modernistic harmonic twitches, little twists, especially toward the end there. And it's a very sort of strong sort of blues-based kind of even sort of rock-flavored kind of big band arrangement, and represents a really interesting attempt on Sinatra's part to find – and Jones's part – to find a synthesis between more contemporary styles and Sinatra's big band background.
Sinatra is now being tributed by a lot of rock performers. Although that there's been this ongoing conflict between rock and pop music.
Well, Joe Piscopo, whose parodies I much admire, represents a kind of continuance of that spirit. And yes, there have been a whole bunch of people who are doing sort of straight nostalgia records led by Ronstadt, but also including a lot of others like Barry Manilow and Tony Tennille and Carly Simon and Willie Nelson. There's even Frankie Goes to Hollywood, this new rich British band, which takes its title from a headline from the early 40s about Sinatra going to Hollywood. But then there's also this appeal of Sinatra as a kind of role model of feistiness. So together, he really represents both spiritually and to some extent musically, but just basically as an icon of popular culture, a model for people of all generations to really look up to.
Well, I've really enjoyed this past hour, and I want to thank you a lot
Great.
For talking with us.